Listening 5. Sociology class.
Listen to part of a discussion in a sociology class. The professor is talking about gangs.
Last class, I asked you to read some articles about gang activity. We're trying to come up with a definition, so let's just go around the table and share what we found. Tracy, will you begin, please?
Okay. Actually, I read a review of the research for sociological studies on gang activity, and I found that gangs have been prevalent for much longer than I'd assumed. I was so surprised. For some reason, I thought that gang activity was a fairly recent phenomenon, but actually, one of the largest studies was carried out by Thrasher in 1936.
Good, good. I'm pleased that you found that. Thrasher's study's a classic research investigation. Can you summarize the findings of the Thrasher study?
Sure. First, I should say that the study included more than 1,300 gangs with more than 25,000 members. So, according to Thrasher, a gang is a group that may form spontaneously. But after that, it'll integrate. And that happens through conflict and violence. Over time, a spirit of solidarity and an attachment to a local territory kind of forms. What's most interesting, besides the long history of gangs in the United States, the interesting part, it's the fact that not much has changed over the years. And, yes, gang behavior seems pretty similar, even across cultures.
That is interesting.
Dr. Jackson, may I go next? I have just a brief comment that seems to fit in here.
Please.
Well, another classic study, much later, about 1987 or 8, I think, by Joan Moore, that study indicated that gang behavior is probably caused by normal adolescent insecurities, the desire for peer approval, respect, support, acceptance, and, in some cases, protection, if the neighborhood's perceived as dangerous. It seems that gangs take the place of the more childish cliques, those in-groups that develop in high schools.
Good point. And if we can refer back to the Thrasher study, he also suggested that gangs actually form in playgroups where children of a very young age begin with the usual games like hide-and-seek or kickball and progress as they get older to playing craps or engaging in petty theft on the street. Now back to Moore. Bill?
Right. Well,
what about Moore's definition of a gang? That relates to the Thrasher study.
Oh, I see what you mean. I have that right here. Moore defined a gang as an unsupervised peer group who is socialized by the streets rather than by conventional institutions. And I was thinking that the institutions might be schools, churches, organized clubs like boys' clubs. And one other thing, Moore emphasized that the gang had to define itself as a gang, you know, with some kind of criteria for membership that'd be recognized by all the gang members.
Such as?
Such as participating in a crime, either stealing something and bringing it back to the gang, or even killing someone in an initiation.
Dr. Jackson, I looked up the definitions of gang members by police departments and law enforcement agencies.
Oh, great. Let's hear it.
Okay. Well, according to the California Youth Gang Task Force, for example, a gang member will be recognizable because of gang-related tattoos, clothing, and paraphernalia like scarves and hats that identify a particular gang, and sometimes these are called the colors. So that allows other people to confirm that the people with the colors on, that they have a right to be on the gang's turf. And to follow up on Tracy's comments about the history of gangs, it looks like these criteria have been in place for a long, long time.
Good job. So far, what I'm hearing refers to gang membership in general. So now let's talk about the ages of gang members. Typically, who belongs to a gang?
Well, this was an eye-opener. There seem to be stages, or maybe not stages, but at least categories of gang membership. It starts about age 10 or 12, which fits in with what you were saying earlier about playgroups. So these kids are playing together and they start writing graffiti on their school lockers or their notebooks, and they look up to the gang members who are about 14 to 20. So the little kids are peewees and the teenagers are called gangbangers. But the members who are 20 to 25 years old, they're the hardcores, and most of the gangs that I read about didn't have very many members over 25 years old. So I would say that, in general, gang membership's for young men.
Thanks for your assessment of membership by age. And I'd certainly agree with you. But what about females? Did anyone find any research on their role in gang activity?
I did. And there are a few girl gangs. That's what they called them in the references. But I found that females are generally not considered members of the male-dominated gang. They're viewed as more of a support system and an extended social group, friends and girlfriends to party with.
That's what I found, too. And another interesting thing, maybe this is naive, but I sort of imagined that gang activity was always criminal activity. But according to a study by, it was James Lasley, he looked at gangs in Los Angeles about 10 years ago. And anyway, he found that they spent a lot of time hanging out, listening to music, drinking beer, and just partying with their girlfriends. And he made another good point. Since they don't have spending money to go places like the movies or ball games, the neighborhood is their entertainment.
Yeah, I read that study. Didn't you say that some of the criminal activity was for fun, not really for financial gain?
Exactly. And there seems to be very little planning, just kind of going with whatever turns up. Of course, there are instances of crimes for revenge or honor to maintain the reputation of the gang, but a lot of the time, crimes simply occur while gang members are looking for something to do.
23. How does the professor organize the discussion? What was surprising about Thrasher's study? 25. According to the study by Moore, what causes gang activity? 26. Listen again to part of the discussion, and then answer the following question.
And one other thing. Moore emphasized that the gang had to define itself as a gang, you know, with some kind of criteria for membership that'd be recognized by all the gang members.
Such as?
Why does the professor say this?
Such as?
What is the role of women in gangs? 28. In the discussion, the students identify aspects of gang activity. Indicate whether each of the following is one of the aspects. Click in the correct box for each phrase.
6. Anthropology class.
Listen to part of a discussion in an anthropology class. The professor is talking about totem poles.
Some of the largest and most elaborate totem poles are those carved by the Haida people, who live on Queen Charlotte Island about 150 kilometers west of the coast of British Columbia, as well as on the smaller islands along the west coast of Canada. These islands are densely covered with huge red cedar trees that have served for many years as the material for the poles. Some of the totem poles are as tall as the trees themselves. Historically, the Haida have carved and raised the totem poles for several important reasons. To honor an elder who's died, to record family ancestry and the accomplishments of the clan, to serve as a reminder for ancient stories that are part of an oral tradition, and to recognize a person who's sponsored a potlatch ceremony. As an aside, the potlatch is a celebration that includes feasting and the exchange of gifts. There might also be singing, storytelling, and dancing, and I'll go into that more a bit later in the semester. But back to the significance of the totem poles. When you see a totem pole, it's obvious that the carvings depict figures of animals and humans stacked one on top of the other. It's probably less clear that the selection and placement of the carved figures is deeply symbolic. So to really understand how important the totem poles are in Haida culture and to have an insight into the symbolism, I want you to think about all of the symbols in a European coat of arms. For example, the coat of arms of Canada includes a unicorn and a lion, a fleur-de-lis and maple leaves. What's the point? Anyone? Come on, I'll give you one guess.
Do you mean that this coat of arms is a symbol? I mean, it identifies the people of Canada.
Precisely, and that's what a totem pole does as well. It identifies the people of a family or clan or village in a symbolic way. The raven and the eagle are usually incorporated in the pole because the Haida people traditionally belong to one or the other of these two important clans. Other animals may recall a time before people lived on the earth, when birds and animals talked with each other, and supernatural events explained history and provided examples for religious teachings. But some symbols and the stories associated with them, these are known only to the owner of the pole, and of course to the carver. Although some symbolic meanings are repeated, such as the association of healing power with the wolf or dignity with the bear, still, it's just not possible to recreate a story merely by looking at the pole. So unless the stories are passed down to relatives or recorded by an anthropologist, then the meaning attached to an individual totem pole can be lost.
Excuse me, I keep thinking about that old expression, low man on the totem pole. How does that fit in to the symbolism, I mean?
I knew someone would bring that up. Okay. Low man on the totem pole means a person with very little status, but actually, we know that this expression isn't at all in keeping with the tradition of carving totem poles. In fact, the lower figures on the totem pole are usually the most important.
Why?
For a very practical reason, not symbolic at all. Remember, the size of a totem pole? Well, it's often carved by more than one artist, usually a master carver and a number of apprentices. And the master carver is the one who carves the bottom 10 feet of the pole, leaving the upper figures to the less experienced apprentices. The most elaborate carving and therefore the most important figures are at the bottom of the pole, where people are able to see them more clearly than they can see the figures at the top. In fact, many totem poles have a thunderbird at the top, which serves as a cap. As the lord of the sky, this choice is logical, but most of the time, it has very little significance in the story of the pole, and it might be the crudest carving.
So did the Haida people worship the totem poles?
That's another old myth. Totem poles were not worshipped and were not used to frighten away evil spirits, as some early records supposed. Now, no one knows exactly how long the Haida have been carving totem poles, and the reason for this is that a cedar pole that's been exposed to the elements, it'll decay in fewer than 100 years. So archaeologists don't have a physical record of totem poles over the centuries. Probably the best description that we have of the tradition dates back to the late 1700s, when European sailing vessels began trading with the Haida. And we know from ships' journals that totem poles were a well-established tradition at that time. Some of them were painted and others weren't. So that option seems to have been left to the discretion of the owner and the carver. Okay, it's almost time for the bell to ring, but I want to mention that although our discussions focused on the Haida, interestingly enough, many other Aboriginal people have a history of carving totem poles as well. Just off the top of my head, I'd have to include the Tlingit and Tsimshian people of Alaska and the Salish people of Western Washington and British Columbia, and the Maori people of New Zealand and the Ainu people from northern Japan. But that isn't an inclusive list by any means.
29. Which of the following is an important reason the Haida people carve totem poles? Listen again to part of the discussion, and then answer the following question.
As an aside, the potlatch is a celebration that includes feasting and the exchange of gifts. There might also be singing, storytelling, and dancing, and I'll go into that more a bit later in the semester.
What does the professor mean when he says this?
As an aside, the potlatch is a celebration that includes feasting and the exchange of gifts.
Why does the professor mention the coat of arms of Canada? What does the saying, low man on the totem pole, mean? 33. Why do the master carvers work on the bottom figures? 34. Listen again to part of the discussion, and then answer the following question.
Just off the top of my head, I'd have to include the Tlingit and Tsimshian people of Alaska, and the Salish people of Western Washington and British Columbia, and the Maori people of New Zealand, and the Ainu people from Northern Japan. But that isn't an inclusive list by any means.
What does the professor mean when he says this?
Just off the top of my head, I'd have to include the Tlingit and Tsimshian people of Alaska and the Salish people of Western Washington and British Columbia.
7. Professor's Office.
Listen to a conversation in a professor's office.
Thanks for seeing me.
No problem. What?
I'm here. Oh, excuse me.
Go ahead.
I'm here because, well, I just don't seem to be able to keep up with the assignments, I mean.
I see. Is that just in my class or is this a general problem?
Oh, no. I'm getting behind in my assignments in all my classes. There's just so much. It's overwhelming. But I came to you because I thought you could give me some advice.
Well, I'll try. So how many classes are you taking?
4, which is about average, I think.
And what are they?
Sorry?
Which classes are you taking?
Oh, well, I have Western Civilization, World Literature, your class in Psychology, of course, and Philosophy.
Uh-huh. Well, that's the problem. All of your courses are reading-intensive classes.
If you mean that I have a lot of reading to do, that's the truth.
Look, when you registered, did you talk with your advisor?
Not really.
But you had to have your advisor's signature in order to complete the registration process.
Yeah, but I just had him sign it. I didn't really make an appointment or anything. See, I thought the best thing to do was to get all of my required courses out of the way so I could spend the last 2 years concentrating on my major.
And that's a good plan. But the problem is that you selected 4 courses that have heavy reading assignments and probably papers to write in addition to tests, right?
Right. But most courses have a lot of reading, don't they?
Some have more than others. And that's what I mean by a reading-intensive class. Listen, if you'd taken a lab course, like botany or chemistry, well, then you would have had one course with a textbook and another course with a small lab manual. Now you'd have had to spend time in the lab to finish your experiments, but you would have received credit for 2 courses, and you wouldn't have had any papers to write, just tests.
Oh, I see. And with the literature, I have 8 books to read, plus the textbook, and there are, how many? 4 or 5 books in your class.
So when you register, you really need to think about the course requirements so you aren't putting all of your reading-intensive courses together in the same semester.
Like I did this time. So maybe it's not that I'm such a slow reader. Maybe I just have too much to read.
Could be. In any case, the schedule has to be at least part of the problem.
So what should I do now?
Okay. Well, how are you doing in your classes?
I'm getting B's and C's, but I know I could get A's if I had more time in the day. And I'm really worried about those C's.
Well, here's a possibility. Why don't you drop one of your courses, the one that takes the most time?
That would be my literature class.
Well, you could take it next semester. It's offered every term, and you'd have some of the reading done already.
But wouldn't that mess up my graduation date?
I don't know. You'd have to check that with your advisor to be sure.
But maybe the professor would be upset about my dropping the class. Then next semester, when I show up again...
You could talk with the professor and explain your plan. But if you decide to do this, you'll need to do it right away because there's a cutoff date for dropping a course. And I think it's the end of this month.
I wish I hadn't gotten myself into this.
Well, the main thing is to learn from it.
So next semester, I could take some reading-intensive courses and some that are less reading-intensive.
And you really should see your academic advisor when you're selecting courses next time. To talk, I mean, not just for a signature.
35. Why does the man go to see his professor? Listen again to part of the conversation and then answer the following question.
So how many classes are you taking?
4, which is about average, I think.
And what are they?
Sorry?
Why does the man say this?
Sorry?
What is the man's problem? 38. What does the professor suggest? 39. What can we infer about the situation?
8. Psychology class.
Listen to part of a lecture in a psychology class.
The National Institute of Mental Health has been doing some interesting research on chemicals in the brain, the neurotransmitters, by looking at brain images, and at least some of the research has shown that the brain circuits responsible for sleep, appetite, concentration, and mood, they're altered during depressed states. So basically, we've concluded that depression's caused by chemical imbalances in the brain. But we're still unclear about what triggers those imbalances in the first place. Some types of depression appear to be genetically inherited, but often there's no family history of depression, or conversely, a person with a family history may never develop a depressive disorder. So it's a thorny problem. Here at the university, we've been studying a disorder called seasonal affective disorder. Norman Rosenthal first identified this disorder in the mid-80s. The theory is that a decrease in light during the long winter months may be responsible for triggering a chemical imbalance that in turn may cause depression among those people with a predisposition to depression. Supposedly, there's an area of the brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is very close to the retina of the eye. So this area of the brain responds to light by sending a signal to the pineal gland, and the signal causes the gland to suppress the secretion of a hormone called melatonin. To make a long story short, the more light, the less melatonin in the blood. Okay, the acronym for seasonal affective disorder that's being used in the field is SAD. We didn't come up with that. And in fact, I personally think that it's an inappropriate way to refer to such a serious type of depression, since it sounds rather mild, and seasonal affective disorder can be a very severe and debilitating disorder for some people. In fact, in extreme cases, it's life-threatening when patients become suicidal. So anyway, as you can appreciate, the winter here is very dark, cold, and gray. By spring, almost everyone's tired of the gloom. But for some people, those suffering with seasonal affective disorder, it can be a serious problem. people with seasonal affective disorder experience deep and prolonged depression throughout the winter months, with what looks like a spontaneous alleviation of the condition when spring arrives. Before the disorder was identified, it was rather a mystery for friends and family, since the depression appeared to vanish only to return several months later. Now, although previous research isn't conclusive, we do know that younger people, especially younger women, these women are at a higher risk for developing the disorder and for being affected by it in a more severe form. If I recall, about 75% of those affected are women, with a typical age of onset about 30 years old. Other factors that contribute to the problem, apart from the long dark days, of course, these factors include heredity and stress. What are the symptoms? Well, the usual spectrum of problems associated with depression: anxiety, lack of concentration, a tendency to sleep more and eat more, cravings for food with a high sugar content. This may be accompanied by weight gain. On the other hand, some people actually lose their appetites and tend to lose a significant amount of weight. We also see lower energy levels, and for some people, a dull headache may accompany the problem. So, building on the research studies that identified the symptoms of seasonal affective disorder and the high-risk profile, we decided to undertake a longitudinal study of 120 subjects, and our research is really focusing on therapies that might help those people affected by SAD. Traditionally, psychotherapy has been used to identify and modify behaviors that contribute to depression, and it's been somewhat successful with patients identified with seasonal affective disorder, especially when used in combination with relaxation and stress reduction therapies. Antidepressant drug therapy has also been proven to reduce depression in studies of people who had seasonal disorders. But we've been using phototherapy almost exclusively with the subjects in our studies. It's very simple, really. We've supplied each subject with a light box that provides the same type of natural lighting that would normally be shining through the window during the spring and summer. The subjects have been instructed to turn on the light box for 2 hours and then simply go about their activities in the room where the box is placed. They're not supposed to use the box like a sun lamp, no staring into the light, either with the eyes closed or open. They just ignore it once it's turned on. So, although we're still evaluating our data from the first group of subjects, we have a few preliminary findings that I'll share with you today. First, we think that it's probably better to be exposed to the light box during the morning hours. Second, we're noticing a relationship between sleep patterns and seasonal depression, so maintaining a regular schedule for sleep seems to be a helpful therapy in conjunction with the light treatment. We're also fairly sure that the duration of light therapy can be modified for individuals. Some subjects who were exposed to the light for less than 2 hours did very well, while others showed no evidence of relief until they reestablished the 2-hour treatments. One interesting possibility that we're working on is whether fluorescent lights might work as well as full-spectrum light with the ultraviolet rays filtered out. In our first trials, we used UV light exclusively, but now we have some trials underway with fluorescent light, and the results so far are encouraging. I'm also happy to report that there are few subjects who are experiencing side effects. There's no evidence of eye damage. We've been careful to filter out any potentially damaging UV rays. And in fact, the only negative side effect was minor headache that seemed to disappear after a few treatments. So, next semester, we plan to begin the second stage of our studies, and we'll be comparing the degree of depression on the part of subjects undergoing light treatments with control groups who'll receive either drug treatments or psychotherapy. What we really want to know is whether light treatments alone are as effective as the other options for therapy.
40. What is this lecture mainly about? What are neurotransmitters? 42. What happens when there is a reduction of light during the winter months? Why does the professor think that the acronym SAD is unsuitable? 44. Listen again to part of the lecture and then answer the following question.
Although previous research isn't conclusive, we do know that younger people, especially younger women, these women are at a higher risk for developing the disorder and for being affected by it in a more severe form. If I recall, about 75% of those affected are women, with a typical age of onset about 30 years old.
What does the professor mean when she says this?
If I recall, about 75% of those affected are women, with a typical age of onset about 30 years old.
45. In the lecture, the professor reports the preliminary results of her research. Indicate whether each of the following is one of the findings. Click in the correct box for each sentence.
9. Physics class.
Listen to part of a discussion in a physics class.
Okay, you'll remember that when Einstein was doing his research, the strong and weak forces, they hadn't been identified yet. But still, he had some questions about the two forces that were generally accepted at the time, electromagnetism and gravity. You see, Einstein thought that nature, or rather a theory of nature, a good theory of nature, had to be much simpler, and to use his term, more elegant. So he spent the next 30 years in an effort to arrive at a unified field theory that he assumed that would demonstrate how these two forces were really defined by one underlying principle. So today, and that would be about 60 years later, a group of physicists believe that they are close to finding that principle in something called the theory of everything. That's okay. A lot of other equally distinguished physicists are also laughing at this idea. But anyway, for the first time in the history of our field, we have a structure, a framework, with the potential to explain every fundamental characteristic of the universe. You see, until fairly recently, we've been conceptualizing the particles, that is, the protons, neutrons, electrons, quarks, and everything else. We've been viewing them as points, very tiny points. But string theory assumes that if we could really take a look at the particles, and that would have to be with technology that we haven't yet discovered, but if we could, then we'd see that the particles aren't points at all, but strings, and these strings are looped back into themselves. Look, think of the strings like a very thin rubber band. Oh, and these strings vibrate.
So everything in the universe is made up of the same thing then? It's all a combination of strings?
According to the theory, yes. But of course, we see differences, and those differences, they're accounted for because the vibrations of the strings are different.
So in physics, you buy into the theory of everything or what?
Well, Jim, the choice isn't that clear. Not at all. There are a lot of scientists in between, and by that I mean that they see the theory of everything in a more limited way. They think that string theory, and understand that string theory is incorporated into the theory of everything, that string theory can explain all of the properties of the forces that cause the particles to interact and influence each other. Yes, Ellen, did you have a comment?
Well, a question, really. Wouldn't it be true that if you understand everything about I think you called it the fundamental characteristics of the universe? So if you understand that, don't you understand everything?
Wait a minute. So that'd mean that we know it all now and there isn't anything else to discover, right? Because everything is physics. Everything's just a reaction between vibrating strings.
I see your point, but you could... You might look at it as a starting place to build our knowledge. Dr. Blake, you said that it'd be a structure, didn't you? So we'd have to fill in a lot of information, but we'd have a structure to start with. In my math class, we were talking about string theory because some of the recent advances in mathematics have been possible because of string theory.
True enough. And string theory isn't finished by any means. It's evolved from the beginning when we first started to think about it, and the early models that included both open strings and the closed strings that I just described to you, the ones that look like a thin rubber band. And there's a lot of discussion about vibration, or rather various types of vibration. Then there's the possibility of brains, B-R-A-N-E-S, which are kind of like closed strings with a membrane over them.
But all of this is theoretical, right? Because we don't have the technology to observe strings, closed or open, and we certainly can't verify that there are brains out there.
Sure, but there are some very complex and persuasive mathematical formulas, and they're presented in support of the theories. It isn't like someone's just dreaming this up without calculations.
But I don't see why we should accept calculations when some of those calculations require us to think beyond what we can observe.
And many physicists would agree with you, Jim. String theory's unverified. Richard Feynman wrote a very interesting book, The Character of Physical Law. And to Feynman, to him, the test of any scientific theory has to be whether the consequences agree with the measurements we take in experiments. Of course, that assumes that the experiment was performed correctly and that the calculations were done without error. But anyway, I think you see the point.
So you're saying that string theory requires further developments?
What do you think?
Well, I tend to be an empirical scientist. I'm a biology major, and I just want to take something into the lab and dissect it.
Fair enough.
But I'm a physics major, and the idea of a theory of everything appeals to me. I know that we can't observe strings yet, but maybe that's just a problem with the technology. And eventually, we may be able to observe strings in the laboratory, or we could find a way to observe strings in a natural setting, and...
Come on. It's just conjecture.
Well, in fairness, any new theory has to begin as conjecture. But the real question is, can string theory pass through the developmental stages to a point where it can be verified or rejected? And these developments could be in the area of technology, like Ellen suggests, or perhaps they could be new methods of performing calculations and deriving the mathematical predictions. What I'm going to suggest is that we take a look at the website that supplements your textbook. There are videos as well as animations, and it includes a really good history of string theory. But that's not why I want you to see it. I think the site demonstrates where we need to go from here if we're going to pursue an ultimate theory. A theory of everything, if you will. And it's fairly objective, so it should provide us with some interesting data for both sides of the debate.
46. What is the discussion mainly about? How does the professor explain the closed string? 48. Listen again to part of the discussion and then answer the following question. Why does the professor say this? 49. According to the discussion, what reason does the man give for rejecting string theory? 50. What can be inferred about the students? 51. Why does the professor suggest that the students visit a website?